Good evening, everybody, and welcome to tonight's webinar, which is around engaging mothers and children affected by family and domestic violence. So tonight's webinar is brought to you in collaboration between Emerging Minds and the Mental Health Practitioners Network. And it's our first webinar for this year. Those of you who have been tuned in to us last year will know that we did provide a series of webinars, which we really enjoyed providing to you, and look forward to the series that's coming this year. Currently, we have about 600 of you logged into this webinar, so welcome to all of you, and also to the viewers who will be watching on podcasts. MHPN and Emerging Minds wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land across Australia upon which our webinar presenters and participants are located. We wish to pay respect to the elders past, present and future for the memories, the traditions, the culture and hopes of Indigenous Australians. So welcome to Series 2, the second year in which, as I mentioned, Emerging Minds and MHPN will be bringing you webinars. This year we've got a fantastic series lined up for you over the course of the next 12 months, which include working to support children and families around fetal alcohol syndrome, working to support the mental health of children with an intellectual disability, as the next two of our in our series over the next 12 months. So we really hope that you subscribe, and to receive your information, please log into www.emergingminds.com.au/subscribe. We really look forward to having your company for this year. So those of you who logged in last year and are logging in this year will notice that there are some changes. Same functionality, different spot. So you may have noticed that the webinar room looks a little bit different. We've had an upgrade through MHPN, and we hope that will provide you with even better services through the webinar. So obviously the purple button there will open the chat box for you, and the blue button there will ask the panel a question. We will try to get through all of your questions tonight. And so please bear with us. We've got about 650 people participating at the moment, and lots of activity in our chat room, which we really appreciate and really does help make these nights really worthwhile. So some learning outcomes for tonight. So we're really wanting to engage you tonight around working with mothers who may come into your services, whether they be specialist services or generalist adult-focused service, to describe the impacts of family and domestic violence on mothers and their children. We want to help you to identify ways of engaging mothers that limit shame and stigma that they may be experiencing. And we also want to help you describe the micro-skills of child-focused practice when working with mothers and children affected by family and domestic violence. So as you can imagine, there's quite a lot to get through. I also mentioned the chat room. So we really look forward to hearing your comments in there. Just please bear with us. Tonight's webinar focuses really strongly on the experiences of mothers and children who are affected by men's violence. This is in response to both the evidence and the experience of practitioners who we work with, who so often see the effects of violence on mothers and children. We do acknowledge that violence does happen in a whole wide range of spheres and relationship contexts, such as same-sex relationships or occasionally from women towards male partners. However, given tonight's focus is on mothers and children, we will be focusing on these issues throughout the webinar and in the chat room, and we hope you find that really useful. So tonight's panel, I'd like to give a really special thank you to, because both Sarah, Erin and Megan have been really influential in a suite of e-learning products that Emerging Minds has recently launched on working with parents, both mothers and fathers, affected by family and domestic violence in child-focused ways. So I'd like to thank, before we start, all three of our participants from that. So let's get started. First of all, Professor Sarah Wendt. Sarah, welcome to our panel tonight. So great to have you here. And Sarah, given your extensive research into family violence, why do you think specialist skills in working with mothers and children are needed in all services?
Hello, good evening. Nice to see you, Dan, and lovely to be here with you all. That's a great question to start off with. I think I just simply want to say I think we do need specialist knowledge in generic services because we know the prevalence of domestic and family violence is quite significant here in Australia and all over the world. And so really simply, just because of its prevalence, we need to know how to respond ethically, safely and kindly in this space.
Great. Thank you, Sarah, and I look forward to your presentation shortly. Next up, we have Dr. Erin Morgan from Uniting Communities. Erin's a senior practitioner in the family and relationship team there. Erin, as a senior practitioner in a non-governmental organisation, what do you think is important in supporting practitioners to work in child-focused ways in the context of family violence?
Hi, Dan. Another good question. I think for me, it's really important to provide practitioners with very rigorous supervision and support around the work. I think that's something that we do in my team. We have a lot of one-to-one and group supervision for people that supports them in their practice. We do lots of co-working practices that support staff who are less familiar in working in these particular ways. So I think it's really important that staff get supported around working with women and with men around issues of violence.
Thanks so much, Erin. Our final presenter tonight is Megan Hughes. Megan's the Executive Manager of Strategic Projects within the Women's Safety Service here in South Australia. Megan, tell me a little bit about your experience in practice and how that might have changed over time in supporting mothers and their children within the domestic and family violence sector.
Yeah. Hi, Dan, and hello, everybody. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for having me. I think it has changed. I think domestic and family violence services over the years have always had a commitment to children and responding to children because distress was evident then as it is now. And I suppose our response was more about seeing children as witnesses rather than as victims. And I think that has probably been the biggest change in our practice, that now we see children as victims. We actually give more comprehensive responses. In the past, it would have been childcare and holiday clubs, and while they're still important and make up a really important part of our work to give children a break from things, we also realise that they need more specialised trauma-informed practice so that they can do the recovering and healing as well.
Thanks so much for that, Megan. Okay, so tonight we're going to be focusing our presentations on Deanne, and many of you will have already accessed the case study of Deanne, who's really starring in the Emerging Minds courses in terms of working with parents affected by family and domestic violence. And we're really inviting you tonight within your own practice context to think about how you might identify the issues that are affecting Deanne and have conversations with her, which allows proactive and child-focused practices to emerge. So I'm going to now pass over to Professor Sarah Wendt as a first presenter tonight. Sarah, welcome.
Excellent. Thank you, Dan. When I first read the case study and I listened to Deanne talk about Peter and their two children, Melinda and Sam, there were three aspects of the story that I noticed. And so to explore these three aspects with you, I'm going to talk about naming family and domestic violence and the risk associated with it. I want to just quickly introduce the idea of restraining ideas with you and finish with the theme of women's work. These three themes, I think, help us understand domestic and family violence firstly. That's why I want to share them with you. But when you understand these three themes, they will also shape how you think about engaging with children and mothers affected by domestic and family violence. I'm going to start off by just naming what I noticed, why I think this noticing is important, and then how such noticing can actually shape our response in practice. So, firstly, when engaging families when domestic and family violence is present, you need to actually understand what it is and the signs of it, and therefore the risk factors associated with domestic and family violence. When you read Deanne in this case study, you can see the signs and the risks. They're evident. When you read and hear the circumstances of Peter, his business is bad, he grew up in a violent home, he's depressed, he drinks, it's actually easy to feel sorry for him. Or you might want to try and understand him. Or you might think, no wonder he's violent. But if we leave that reaction there, we can actually ignore the signs of domestic and family violence, and we can miss the risks that are associated with it. We actually have to take a step back and listen to what Deanne is sharing so that we can notice the signs and we can name the risk presented. So before I tell you what I noticed, I think it's important that we know what domestic and family violence is. And let me just read a definition to you. We understand that domestic violence refers to acts of violence that occur between people who have or have had an intimate relationship. Now, while there's no single definition, the central element of domestic and family violence is an ongoing pattern of behaviour aimed at controlling a partner through fear, for example, by using behaviour which is violent and threatening. So in most cases, the violent behaviour is part of a range of tactics to exercise power and control over women and their children. These can be criminal and non-criminal. Domestic violence includes, of course, physical, sexual, emotional, psychological abuse, as well as financial and social abuse. So when you read this case study and you actually listen to Deanne, you can see these forms of abuse. It actually says his behaviour changes and he becomes violent towards Deanne. That could mean physical or sexual violence. Always done sneakily with sly acts of violence that hurt, but are not overt or easy to spot. So this is the much more insidious forms of violence. For example, sexual violence in intimate partner relationships could be hinted at there. She's feeling afraid of his behaviour, which has started to escalate, and his moods have become increasingly angry and loud, even when sober. We need to recognise that this is emotional and psychological abuse for Deanne and for her children. And we need to recognise that this creates fear and trauma in people's lives. They're always short on money. Deanne doesn't want to tell Peter about this. There is signs of financial abuse. So for me, yes, this is family and domestic violence. Research and practice has also shown that there are many factors at risk, and some risk factors are associated with a higher likelihood of violence reoccurring, serious injury or death. The research shows us that the risk factors are a history of domestic and family violence, which we see in this case study, separation, actual or pending, intimate partner sexual violence, which has been hinted at, non-lethal strangulation, stalking, threats to kill, a perpetrator's access to weapons, but also the escalation, which we see in this case study, and coercive control, which we also see. So you need to listen to Deanne when we're trying to understand the signs and the risks. I also, when you hear Deanne telling her story and we learn about the circumstances of Peter, we also need to balance this fine line of collusion. Yes, we can feel concern for Peter, absolutely, but men have choices in how they behave. We cannot imply that men cannot control themselves. For example, he was just drunk. Look, Peter's distressed because of his work. It's because Peter is depressed. Or it's because of Peter's childhood. What these messages or moments of collusion do is actually diminish the seriousness of domestic and family violence, and it actually positions it as inevitable. And that minimisation, what does that do to women and children like Deanne and Melinda and Sam? So then rather focusing on men's use rather than by focusing on why men use violence, you know, what causes men to be violent, why is Peter violent because of his childhood, for example, I have found the concept of restraining ideas more useful. This is an idea that's been introduced to us by Alan Jenkins, which turns attention and interest into what stops men from behaving and choosing respectful behaviours. So exploring what restrains men from living in accordance with their ethical preferences can provide a practitioner with that engagement input and endpoint that is safe. By exploring his values, his beliefs, his ethics, it's more likely then for men to realise how particular ideas have shaped them, like their drinking, their depression, their childhood abuse. And what is it about these things that stops them from reaching their ethical preferences? So for me, restraining ideas can help men realise and reconnect with the principles of responsibility and accountability because it's personal. It resonates with them, and then they're more likely to turn attention to the effects on women and children. So lastly, before I finish up, I also just want to point out how much work women do to survive domestic and family violence. We know, firstly, that women cope on their own. The research has shown this over and over again. They cope on their own for long periods of time. They try and placate and understand their partner. Women will also feel shame and embarrassment during this phase, but almost always women will seek help either through informal networks or formal networks. And so I think this is important to remember, the history that women come with when they do seek help, and to recognise this survival and this strength. I also noticed something from Deanne's story, that it's common in family and domestic violence, the extent to which women contribute to the pathways for men to seek and receive help. Women often enable and supplement this formal intervention. Women spend a lot of time getting men ready to go and seek help about their behaviour. I also just want to note and pause that domestic and family violence impacts on parenting. It impacts on mothering in very complex ways. When women are traumatised by their abuse that they're experiencing, their coping actually becomes compromised. Their mothering can become compromised. They might be less available to their children. Attachment relationships become compromised, particularly for infants and toddlers. But I also want to point out that mothers may also compensate for domestic and family violence by actually trying to protect their children. And so it's important to start with the protection and the strength. That's one way you'll engage a woman much, much better than pointing out her deficits. I also want to note that there is a lot of lack of attention on fathering when men are violent. So men's lack of impulse control, their entitlement, their inability to understand the impact of their violence, and their modelling of physical violence and abuse and the threat of it also impacts significantly on children. So it's important in this case study to highlight Peter's fathering and how that will be impacting on Melinda and Sam. It's not all about what Deanne is doing as a mother or not doing or stopping the violence. Lastly, I just want to finish up by saying that domestic and family violence does threaten children's safety. It undermines children's secure attachments. And all work around domestic and family violence, particularly with the perpetrator and parents, should be about achieving safety and stability for the child. And this will also mean achieving safety and stability for the non-offending parent, which is often the mother. A safe mother is more likely to be able to attend to the emotional, social and development needs of their child. So attention must always be on how the perpetrator undermines the safety of the mother-child relationship and the risk he poses on this, and that needs to be monitored throughout any work with him. So I might finish there and hand over to the next speaker.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Really appreciate that informative and insightful talk. Okay, so next for you tonight we have Dr. Erin Morgan, who is going to talk about Deanne from her experience as senior practitioner in family services at Uniting Communities. Erin.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks, Sarah. So I'm going to talk about it from a counselling perspective. So I can hear from Deanne that there are some significant risks to the safety and well-being of Melinda and Sam. She's noticed their behaviour's changed, they're avoiding their father, and they even appear frightened of him. She's also becoming worn down by Peter's use of abusive behaviour. And over the long term, the effects of this pose a threat to her ability to parent in her usual way. Women often become exhausted from the continual abuse, and the quality of their relationship with their children can suffer as a result. This has the potential to leave the children even more exposed to their father's use of abuse. But I'm also concerned for Peter's safety. His alcohol consumption is increasing and his use of violence is no longer limited to when he is drinking. This escalation is worrying, as there is no clear way to know where it's going to end. If Peter becomes a risk to himself, the risk to Deanne and the children also increases. So with many women and children that I see around domestic violence, there's many risk and protective factors. At the moment, I think the risk factors for this family outweigh the protective factors. And so I think it's important to be trying to engage Peter in counselling as soon as possible. Now, this does several things. It supports Peter to understand that he is in the best position to improve the safety and well-being of his family. It takes the responsibility off of Deanne to manage his behaviour while also linking her in with supports. And it reassures the children who can be involved in counselling with their mum. So Deanne says that Peter no longer has a relationship with Sam and Melinda. Now, they'll no doubt be feeling the loss of this and reacting to it. This increases Deanne's parenting responsibilities at a time when she is exhausted with managing his behaviour, protecting the children, and trying to keep them going financially. In situations of significant domestic violence, I don't see couples together. I would see Deanne separately, either with or without the children. Counselling provides her with an opportunity to talk about their concerns, fears and hopes for their relationships with Peter. I think it's important, particularly from the children's perspective, to separate Peter's behaviour from who he is. So from the dad the children still love and may want a relationship with. It can be heartbreaking for a child to think their dad does not love them anymore. Counselling is a space where they can speak about what worries them about how their dad has been acting and many of the conflicting feelings that arise as a result of this. Sorry, I'm just skipped one there. For many men, the threat of losing their partner and children is what motivates them to attend counselling. However, this motivation can be short-lived if the partner does leave and take the children. For Peter to engage in counselling, he has to be willing to take some responsibility for his actions and to make a commitment to changing his behaviour, whatever else Deanne decides to do. If Peter becomes engaged and stays engaged in counselling, the outcomes for Deanne and the children are going to be much better. Men attending counselling for their use of violence and abuse are often in a dilemma. They know that their behaviour is not acceptable, but at the same time, they often feel entitled to act in those ways. This poses a barrier to them taking responsibility for the pain that they have caused. I use an invitational approach which supports a man to step into accepting responsibility for his actions, to bring forward his values and to take a position about what he's been doing. Apart from Peter's use of violence, I also want to attend to Peter's use of alcohol, his fluctuating moods and his financial problems. I do this to be respectful of the stresses in his own life and the struggles he has had and is currently encountering. However, these discussions do not promote the idea that any of these factors are causative of his behaviour. I will repeatedly invite him to take responsibility for his behaviour and will respectfully interrupt any attempts on his part to blame his family or external factors. It's often easier. If Peter does take on responsibility for his actions, he's also very likely to connect with feelings of shame. Shame can have him feeling too uncomfortable to continue with counselling. So it's important to assist Peter to work through this. So I might ask Peter a question like, what would it say about you if you did not feel ashamed of some of your behaviours? Questions like this can encourage Peter to take a position against the use of violence and reposition shame as a motivating force for change. It's often easier for men to connect with responsibility in relation to their children rather than their partner. By focusing on the children in our conversations, I might ask Peter questions like, what would you see if you looked at this situation through your children's eyes? Do you think Sam and Melinda are scared of you? What have you seen or heard that tells you they are frightened of you? What is it like to know you have this effect on them? Is this the sort of dad you want for them, or would you prefer to be a different sort of dad? What sort of dad would you like to be for Sam and Melinda? These questions can focus him back into thinking about the effect his behaviour is having on his children. And assessing Peter's response to counselling can be really the only effective way of assessing any change in Peter's behaviour. We'll be hearing the experiences of Deanne, of Sam and Melinda. When working with men around their use of violence, it's vital to be able to hear the voices of his partner and his children. Behaviour change is difficult, even for the most well-intentioned of men. And so the feedback from Deanne and the children will be the only way I'll have any idea of how effective counselling has been. I'll leave it there, Dan.
Would you like me to begin, Dan?
I think you should, Megan.
Thanks, Sarah. So Sarah and Erin have given us a really good indication and an insight into what's happening for Deanne and Peter and the children. My focus on this presentation is really going to be probably from a bird's eye view of organisationally, what do we need to look like organisationally and as workers to meet these people in ways that are going to be helpful and are going to make a difference. So I'm going to speak through an organisational lens that speaks to what services, businesses, agencies need to look like which support disclosure of domestic and family violence and builds trust and confidence in women and children when they're seeking help. I think to begin with, that first impressions matter when women who are experiencing domestic and family violence are seeking help. So when one in four women who walk through a generalist store or a private practice are going to have a previous or current history of domestic and family violence, all staff that have contact with these customers require some basic training. So for a woman like Deanne, who has not yet identified that she's experiencing domestic violence, is worried about putting food on the table, is frightened by her husband's unpredictable moods and reactions, and can't even share with him her concerns about the family and where it's heading, her antennae for people judging her is going to be pretty high. And so that's why it's really important that we're really careful about the language we use and our approach. Because if we believe that it's going to take all of us to prevent domestic and family violence, which I think is true, we need to start at the very first contact to ensure that Deanne and her children feel like that they have come to the right place and the people in this place are trustworthy, respectful and know what they're doing. If we don't meet this first criteria, the very great risk is they might wait until things are much more serious before they visit a service again. So I think getting it right the first time is something that we all really have to take seriously and need to look at our own organisations about how are we doing that. It's important that when we meet people like Deanne and other women that walk, that come through our service door, is that we always have a domestic and family violence lens, because we know that it is widespread in Australia and globally, and so therefore we've got to have an expectation that we are going to meet this regularly in our work. So while the receptionist might not need to know the signs that make us curious about what is happening in Deanne's family, it could make a big difference if the financial counsellor that Deanne was seeing and visiting had a basic understanding of domestic violence and what the indicators were for this. So what I'm probably saying is we've got to think about the usual and the not so usual suspects in terms of our staff cohort, about who needs to have some basic level of training so that they can at least identify it, or might know to bring in somebody else in the organisation that has more practice, you know, more experience than we have, so that they can be there to support when necessary. And I know we have a financial counsellor at our service that women in our service see, and I am always amazed at just the difference that that makes, because she has comes from a, she has met domestic violence in her work a lot and has an interest in it. And it's incredible the rapport that she quickly builds with women. So, and when we build that rapport, of course we can find out more about her, that she, that Deanne's not reticent or holds back because she's not sure of what that outcome will be. So, and having people like that in our organisations open doors for further work, which might make all the difference in that family. I also want to talk about the networks that we're involved in and how important they are, particularly in the work we do, because many services, not just specialist services as we know, come in contact with domestic and family violence, but often it's the network meetings that, when we're really busy, get dropped off the to-do list, and are the most expendable things in our diaries. And I would like to challenge that tendency in our agencies or in our practices. We need to understand that each of us in this work plays a role in supporting and preventing domestic and family violence in our society and in our community. For this to be effective, we need to know whom we are working with, what they are doing, and how we can coordinate and collaborate the work that we are doing together. So that I know that, in this centre, we have a particularly good counsellor who is experienced in domestic and family violence, which I can do some basic work with them, but I need for them to have more comprehensive, therapeutic responses. So, but if I don't know that, if I don't know the people in my community, I'm not going to be able to pass her on to anybody. So I think it's really important because I see the network meetings are kind of like the infrastructure to support services like libraries are in neighbourhoods. If we don't know what's happening in our own area, then we're operating in bubbles and we are letting our clients down. Networks provide opportunities for us to build and share our understandings of the work and a shared language, and that makes all the difference when we need to work together and build a system that works effectively and creates new pathways for women, children and men. I also thought, just building on some of the things that Erin was talking about and Sarah, is what are some ways in which we can effectively engage women in conversation for their support. And we know that engagement of the client has got to be one of the most critical factors in building trust and relationship that leaves Deanne feeling like she is in the right place and this organisation can help her and her kids. So this might mean that we need to pay attention to the needs of her children, Melinda and Sam. They've probably come with her to that appointment. Maybe there are some activities for them to do while Deanne is talking with a financial counsellor. So to have our reception areas and our spaces available so that Deanne can have the space she needs to do what she needs to do, and the children feel like they can be seen in that space and can be doing something and occupied. We really need to listen to Deanne's story and to avoid driving our own agenda or trying to impose upon what she's telling us, so that we need to give conversation time. So in that financial counselling appointment, it might mean dropping the budget and spending more time talking to her about what's really happening. We need to respond to what Deanne is saying that in a way that tells her that you believe what she is saying. So that's really important, that we are open and that she can see that we are using language that is supportive, strength-based, and recognising the things that she's already doing in her relationship, which kind of moves into validating her experience. So it could be something like, "It sounds like you've been going through a really rough time at the home. You must be really calling on all your reserves to do this." You know, really acknowledging the effort that she's putting in. And we need to ask about the kids and how they're going, and to acknowledge the protective behaviours that she might already be demonstrating. So saying things like, "It's really hard to parent when these things are happening in your relationship, and it seems like you're doing an amazing job to hold it together for the sake of the kids." So these are just some ways in which we are really demonstrating to her that we see her and we see the difficult and painful situation she's in. And finally, I just, as we know, One woman dies every week and a child every fortnight due to domestic and family violence in Australia. This is not an easy issue, as certainly it's certainly not for the family, but as important the worker, they're really complex, difficult issues, and we really need to take the risk and safety seriously. So I would say that if we need to take them seriously, and if you're concerned with what you're hearing from Deanne, I think it's really important to name it. And to say that, and to tell her that how concerned you are, and that, and offer her any assistance that might keep her safe tonight in particular. And of course, there's 1-800-RESPECT and domestic violence crisis lines, I think, in every state in Australia. So they are really useful resources. If you're feeling out of your depth, those people on the end of those lines can help you through it. So I think that's me, Dan.
Thank you so much, Megan. Really appreciate that. And thanks so much again to all of our three presenters. I'm sure that the 900 of you who are online will agree that they were really insightful and thoughtful presentations. But that's not the end of it. We're now going to take some questions from our very busy chat room. So first of all, there's quite a lot of questions for you, Sarah, and particularly around this question around how do we identify violence in generic services and engage with people in those generic services? What are the sort of skills and assessments that we need?
Oh, wow, what a great question to start off with. Thanks, Dan. I think to try and answer those two components, how do we identify violence in generic agencies? I think my key message has to go back to you need to understand what it is. What are we talking about? And so we are talking about coercive control and a pattern of behaviour that's threatening, and it's a use of power. We now know that domestic violence is made up of lots of different tactics, from physical, sexual, emotional, psychological, and financial abuse. So how do you identify violence in generic services? You have to understand and know the signs of it, would be my first response. When we go to the next level, kind of what are the skills or the assessments that's needed in this space, that's when I think it becomes a little bit more tricky. So once you recognise it, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to understand the risk? You need to understand what you're assessing for. And so I hope that my little spiel on the high risk factors was useful for people. But I also want to say, when we're thinking about assessment, comprehensive assessment in domestic and family violence is absolutely paramount when we're talking about children's safety and when we're talking about women's safety. So when we want to keep it to being child-centred, assessment must centre on the child's situation, the parenting and the parenting capacity, and the likeliness of reoccurrence and violence and the risk. So a child's safety is paramount. However, I also want to point out that to be child-centred, we also have to focus on, you know, the non-offending parent. And it's also easy, though, to focus on what they're doing or not doing. So we can unintentionally shift blame to the non-offending parent. And often in our society, in our culture, that's been to mum. So what's she doing to stop it? Why is she allowing it? Why isn't she leaving? So I think we need to be very aware in our assessments that we're not just focusing on mum. Our assessment needs to turn to the risk associated with the perpetrator and his behaviour. And so a good risk assessment would be, I think, focused on him, his pattern of behaviour, the escalation of that behaviour, the signs that we've recognised. And so for me, I want to highly encourage that assessment is about him and the risks that he poses to the partner and to his children. Before I kind of finish up on that, Dan, I also felt, I'm not sure if people are aware, but if people go to the ANROWS website, that's the Australian National Research Organisation for Women's Safety, they now have up there the National Risk Assessment Principles, And so there is this wonderful guide that's been based in evidence, in research, about what should be those core basic principles when you're assessing for domestic and family violence. I highly encourage people to go and have a look at them. I also, though, think that every agency has a responsibility to actually having their own risk assessment tools and frameworks that are built from an evidence-based, and we have many of those as well, and that website can help agencies with them.
Thanks so much for that, Sarah. I really appreciate that that comment and answer that question. Erin, the next question's from you. Lots of people are picking up on your comment around not always engaging in relationship counselling or couples counselling in the context of family violence. Can you tell us a little bit about how you'd make that decision and how you decide whether it was safe or beneficial to engage in couples counselling?
Yeah. I don't think it's possible to be doing relationship counselling as such when there is violence present in the relationship. So, and the reason I say that is often I will see couples come into counselling and they will describe situations around communication difficulties or arguments. And on further discussion and investigation about these arguments, there are often situations where the woman is becoming very frightened of what's happening and his behaviour is becoming very loud or aggressive or developing into an abusive pattern over time. In these situations, it's not possible to do relationships counselling because relationship counselling suggests to a couple that violence is not an issue in the relationship and that other factors are that, you know, for a man will often think things that, you know, if his partner would only listen better or if she would do things the way he asked her to, that this is the communication problem that is causing the arguments. And so these things have to be teased out very carefully. If a woman is frightened of her partner, then I would look to be working separately with them or to have either of them work with another counsellor and I'll work with one of them. But I just don't think relationship counselling is at all possible when there's violence present. Now, the only exception I would make to that is there have been occasions I have worked with couples, but that's been in a situation where the woman has made it extremely clear that she is not frightened of her partner, that she is not worried about the consequences of what happens when they talk in a counselling session and they leave together and they go home, because that's often a very telling situation. But I have to be fairly convinced that the woman's safety is ensured before I would continue to see a couple together.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Erin. Megan, how would you directly support children within your service who are living with violence? Would you work with them directly?
In our face-to-face services, we absolutely work with them directly. So when children come into our services with their mother, they will receive, in most cases, an individual child assessment, which looks at how they're managing, what their needs are at this moment in time. But we'll also work with them in groups in most of our services, so have opportunities for kids to be together and have fun, but also touch on kind of what they're experiencing, how they're travelling. And some, you know, exercises that help them talk about managing emotions and things like that. And we'll also do some work with them as a family together to try and build resilience, but also do some repair work between the mother and the child, because that work that relationship has also been targeted usually by the partner to weaken their relationship so he has more power and control. So that there's a lot of damage that's been done in to that relationship. So we really need to have some focus around those, on that relationship. In terms of, we've got telephone-based programs as well. And so while we won't speak directly to children, we'll have child-focused conversations with the mother, talking about the talking about how the children are. We'll work through some strategies about when children are not managing very well. We'll connect them to services in their state to get the therapeutic work that that child needs. And we'll also have an opportunity to share resources with them so that we can email. There's a lot of things that Emerging Mind produces and RASA and other services in this space that actually have helpful tips for mums, and so we'll make sure that the women can access those so that they can implement them in their home, and we'll do some follow-up with that.
Great, thanks Megan. Sarah, you and Erin spoke about the role of working with Peter and engaging him. What does the evidence tell us about engaging men who use violence? And is there new evidence or promising practice in this field that is emerging?
Yeah. You know, Dan, I do want to acknowledge that the perpetrator space, you know, when we're asking questions about what works and what is success and what is effective, those answers aren't easy, and they're quite contested. But what we do know, if we're going to go back to this, question of engagement, you know, this need to understand how to engage men better to enable, you know, attitudinal behaviour change, it has actually started to become the focus of research at the moment. But whether engagement leads to success or change is also still the million-dollar question. But when we look at the literature or the research, we've found that best practice in perpetrator intervention requires that men are actively engaged, you know, in interactive sessions over a sustained period of time. And we've also found that when men receive services, when it's done in a coordinated community response, that often has much more success as well. It's also been shown that men receive or engage much better when they are receiving positive messages about that they can change, that this isn't deterministic. That kind of positive reinforcement about, you know, who do you want to be and you can be that person has also, the research has shown, has enabled engagement. So wanting to be better. So the research kind of does show those things as being successful in terms of engagement. But the link between engagement and whether a man actually goes through a journey of behaviour and attitudinal change in maybe what we say is successful or what's effective at the end is probably still contested. I suppose when you say what might be new, like in this space, again, I feel like I'm doing a bit of a plug for ANROSE tonight, but if you're not familiar with the Australian National Research for Organisation for Women's Safety, they did commission some research, particularly around perpetrator interventions. And one of the key priority areas of that research agenda was having a look at engagement and engagement of men. And I was fortunate enough to do a study and have a look at a study around using narrative and invitational ways of working to engage men, attitudinal change. And that's about to be released on the ANROSE website on my any week now. But to share with you or give you some glimpses into what we found, what was particularly useful or working from invitational and narrative ways of working, was this respectful alliance. made from the start with men, making it possible that change was able to happen. Also, positioning men as competent and in their behaviour change, so not seeing them as deficit. So this kind of moving away from being deviant or this is deterministic or this is hopeless to men as competent and therefore able to engage in conversations about their use of violence, where that comes from. Because once that's established, we also found practitioners then can have much more rich discussions about shame, the shame that men might feel, the effects that it has on women and children. And you can't leap to that with a man who's not ready to have those conversations. And so scaffolding it with who he wants to be and that he can change and then going to shame and exploring effects is then opens up this moment or these key moments of change where men can name the violence that they're using without minimising or blaming others around them. So I have to say I feel a bit optimistic about narrative and invitational ways of working because of the scaffolding of the journey they take men on. And so the rationale behind it is if it resonates with men and their own stories and their own context and they can recognise that effect, it's more likely to have sustainable change. But having said that, we also found that such approaches like narrative and invitational ways of working is slow work. So you cannot rush those conversations. We spoke to some men who were receiving 2 years of therapy and still were only just naming key moments of change. And so I think as a society or as a government or as a community or even as families, we cannot underestimate the extent and the long-term change that's required to work with men and alongside them to enable sustainable change. And that's kind of the million-dollar question.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that, Sarah. And just we've had quite a few people just inquiring about the name of the ANROADS assessment tools that you've been referring to.
Yeah, sure. So if people go onto the ANROADS website, let me just make sure I get it up, Dan. If you Google ANROADS and then you search their website, you'll actually come across, it's called the National Risk Assessment Principles. So if you search inside ANROADS website, the National Risk Assessment Principles, you'll see it sitting there for public access.
Great. Thank you very much. Erin, some questions from Chris and from others. Really about working with Deanne and mothers, about how might you work with them in ways which help them to name the effects of violence on their children, but at the same time don't step into colluding with mother blame or stigma?
I think women, for a variety of reasons, aren't always willing or able to name violence, and it might be a range of reasons. Sometimes women are just so shell-shocked, exhausted, that they're unable to think about the experience they've been having. They've been unable to process it and been able to think about it in terms of violence. Sometimes women are very frightened that if they speak about they and their children being subjected to violence, that the children will be removed. Sometimes they're just overwhelmed with shame at the thought that they've been living in a situation where relatives or friends may have been saying to them, you know, why aren't you leaving? Why aren't you doing something about this? And they feel very beaten down about it. So I guess the working in a very invitational way with women as well is to really try to understand their experience, is to not rush them, is to listen very carefully to what they're saying and invite them to think about how they would describe their partner's behaviour and what they would make of it. And to ask them a lot about their children's experience, what they've been noticing. So if they've been noticing that the children are frightened, what they make of that, what they would think if that was happening to a friend's children, how they would describe their friend's partner's behaviour. And often women know that, you know, even if they can't name it as violence, they'll know that it's not right. They'll know that it feels terribly wrong. But admitting it to someone can be stressful, it can be dangerous, it can be frightening. And so, women for a variety of reasons can find that difficult. On the other hand, I think, you know, as Megan mentioned too, there are times when the risk seems so high in situations when I'm speaking with a woman that I might suggest to her, you know, does this sound like violence to you? You know, when I speak with other women and they describe these sorts of things to me, that's domestic violence. What do you think of that? And often women will agree. Sometimes women feel quite shocked at this idea that they've been experiencing violence. They know they've been experiencing something terrible, but to put that name to it still comes as quite a shock to them. So I think for me it's very dependent on the circumstances, the degree of violence being experienced, and the I guess the level or the speed at which a woman can come along in the conversation. So I'm not wanting to rush women and stress them even further. I'm also not wanting to leave the situation if I feel the risk is really high. So, it really depends.
Great. Thank you, Erin. We have Megan, time for one quick answer to a question, which
yep.
you know doesn't deserve a quick answer. But Louise and other people on our chat room are really asking about this kind of tension between engaging really well with mothers, but also understanding the context of mandatory reporting where children are at risk. Any kind of final hot tips on that?
Yeah, I mean, can I just build on what Sarah, I think, was saying about really rather than looking at, we need to understand what the experience of the child is. And so therefore, we need to understand the violence they've been exposed to. But often what we work with the person who's in front of us with the child, which is usually the mother. And therefore, we kind of make her responsible for fixing it for the child. I think we need to, again, really become specific about the violence that's been experienced in that house and about where we locate the harm. So if it's failure to protect the child, who is failing to protect? The man who's using the violence in the relationship or the woman who's a victim of it. So I think we really need to get that straight in our own heads so that when we do have to report, when we've got mandatory reporting obligations, we need to be able to describe what's really happening in that family and not make the victim, who is also the mother, responsible for that violence. Now, she has a responsibility as a mother, but I think we need to be aware of locating the harm and damage that's occurring in the right place so that men remain accountable for the violence that's being used in relationships. And I think we need to be more interested in the protective factors because ultimately we want to keep those children safe and they're going to be safest with a protective parent who is able to parent in the way they need to. And so if we remove violence, if we address the violence that's being perpetrated in this relationship, then I think we can balance those issues.
Thanks so much, Megan. And thanks again to all of our panellists and the 915 of you who are listening to this webinar. What I'm going to do now is just ask each of our panellists to sum up really quickly with any final thoughts or observations. Sarah, I'll start with you if that's okay.
Sure, Dan. So really quickly, I think some of the key messages from tonight is don't be scared to have conversations about domestic and family violence. So don't be scared to have conversations with her or him about it. Name it for what it is. Be curious and explore it. Put yourself in the shoes of the victim and the child. And so that will enable us to also turn our attention to so who is perpetrating this violence, and that keeps the perpetrator visible. So they're kind of my take-home messages, Dan. Don't be scared to ask. Think what it would be like for the woman and the child, which then makes it possible to keep the perpetrator visible and centred in how we understand the risk.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. Erin, your final thoughts?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, Sarah. And I think what I'd add is that to maintain a real focus on keeping children safe, often engaging with men is a way to get access to their female partners and their children in a way that women might not come forward to a service on their own because of all the things that we've talked about tonight, but that we can get access in working with men. We always ask them for partner contact details, and that's a pivotal part of our work, that through engaging with men, we get access to their partners, we get to get a good assessment about what risks are there for the partner and the children, and that through accessing the partner and children is the only way we actually really know if counselling with men is working, because the partner is in and the children are in the best position to be saying what changes they're noticing. And that's the important thing, because men can tell us that they're changing, that they're accepting responsibility for their actions, that they're learning these new ways of being with their families, but it's really about where the rubber hits the road, and the only way we can know that is to hear directly from the source. So I think that's a real focus.
Thanks so much, Erin. And Megan, your final thoughts?
I suppose I'd like to leave people with making the most of every encounter we have with women and children seeking our help. They are so important, and we know that the sooner we are able to work with these issues in families, the better that family is going to be. If you've got entrenched, if people have left it long periods of time of being in domestic violence, really does incredible damage to everybody in that family. And so the sooner we can get to it, the better that family is going to be, and the likelihood of them moving on and being and increasing their well-being and reaching their potential. So I would say make the most of those moments that we have with women, children and men. Know how important that is, and also make sure that our organisations are places where they feel they can get the help they need. And that's going to be by you know, being the face of understanding.
Great. Thank you so much, Megan. Really appreciate that. And again, to all our three panellists, I'm sure that you'll all agree have been really informative tonight, so thank you. Okay, so Please, tonight, just for our audience, have a look at the Supporting Resources tab, which is the light blue icon at the top right of your screen. There you'll find a whole lot of domestic family violence resources, including the latest suite of e-learning products that Emerging Minds has just produced. Can you also please complete the exit survey and provide feedback by selecting the yellow icon at the top right of your screen. The next webinar in our series will be Working to Support Children and Families Living with Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder, and that will be on Thursday night on the 26th of September. We look forward to joining you there. The next MHPM webinar will be Do You Have What It Takes to Engage with Indigenous People, and that will be on Thursday the 19th of September. A few words before we leave about the partnership between MHPN and Emerging Minds. This webinar was co-produced by MHPN and Emerging Minds for the Emerging Minds National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health Project. The project is led by Emerging Minds and delivered in partnership with the Australian Institute of Family Studies, the Australian National University, the Parenting Research Centre and the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. MHPN supports the engagement and ongoing maintenance of practitioner networks where clinicians from different disciplines meet regularly with other mental health practitioners, share tips and resources, build referral pathways and engage in CPD activities. To learn more about joining your local practitioner network, please visit mhpn.org.au. You can also indicate your interest in the exit survey. Before I close, I'd like to acknowledge the consumers and carers who have lived with mental illness in the past and those who continue to live with mental illness in the present. Thank you to our facilitators and thank you to everyone for your participation this evening. Good night.